Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today is our last installment of Full Bio, our monthly book series where we take an in-depth look at a deeply researched biography. This week, we've been discussing True, The Four Seasons of Jackie Robinson by Kostya Kennedy, a book divided into four sections examining pivotal years in Robinson's life. Each part is assigned a season, and we have arrived at winter in the year 1972. Well, 2022 marks the 75th anniversary of Robinson breaking the color line in Major League Baseball. It also marks the 50th anniversary of Robinson's death. In his later years, Robinson concentrated on civil rights and educational opportunities for young people. He was someone who worked within the system, which irked some younger civil rights leaders. He was also estranged from Major League Baseball for years. Robinson was frustrated that years after he broke the color line, there were still no black managers in the game. In 1969, he turned down an invitation to a New York Yankees old-timers game saying, quote, "My pride in my blackness requires that until I see genuine interest in breaking the barriers that deny access to managerial and front office positions, I will say no." But in 1972, he did say yes to an event and appeared at a ceremony honoring him before Game 2 of the 1972 World Series, and he took advantage of the moment.
I'm extremely proud and pleased to be here this afternoon, but must admit I'm going to be tremendously more pleased and more proud when I look at that third base coaching line one day and see a black face managing in baseball. Thank you very much.
Jackie Robinson died 9 days after this event at age 53. Here's our final installment of Full Bio with Kostya Kennedy about his book, True, The Four Seasons of Jackie Robinson. We're going to 1972, the chapter you titled Winter, and it's the year that Robinson died, and you devote a lot of the chapter to his family and his wife, Rachel, who we'll get to that in a moment. When did the family relocate to Connecticut, and why, and what was life like for the Robinsons in Connecticut?
Yeah, so they were again looking for a more comfortable life, a better life, and they were looking initially in various parts around the New York area. It was in the 50s, so he was still a player with the Dodgers. They still, of course, had to be near enough for him to come in. They found a lot of resistance in Westchester County and Lower Connecticut. They would go and be bidding on a house, and then a real estate broker would learn that they were black, and suddenly the house would disappear. And it was a very difficult and discouraging time, but they did get in Stamford through the help of some friends who sort of made sure it could happen, and really just wanted to embrace that kind of life. And it was apart from living in Addisley Park, which was in Queens, which was had a large black population, where he lived there in the early 50s. Most of his life, Robinson lived in white neighborhoods, and this is what was happening when they moved to Connecticut, specifically to Stamford. His kids were the first black kids in their school's classes, so integrating on that level. They went to a church, and they expressed later some potential rethinking of it. They, instead of joining a black church, they joined a community church, which was predominantly white. And that was the environment that they lived in for the last 17, 18 years of Robinson's life.
You brought up his children, and growing up the only black kid in a school system is tough enough. But you grew up with famous parents, and the only black kid in a new school system. And his son, Jackie Jr., had a hard road. He served in Vietnam. He had drug issues, and he went to rehab. And you note that Jackie Sr. felt some responsibility for his son's troubles. How so?
Yeah, so all that is exactly as you described with Jackie Jr., not only being the son of a famous father, but being actually called Jackie Robinson Jr. Mm. Jackie Jr. died in a single car crash in 1971. This was after he had gone through rehab and appeared to be fully clean, but he had this accident on the Hutchinson River Parkway. And after that, obviously we talked about it, and he did express a lot of regret, and specifically saying this was moving to come across that, you know, maybe I spent so much time worrying about other kids and other people's children and not enough with my own. And I think he felt some regret that he had been too distant from his son. Initially, Jackie Jr. was the first of their children born and so lived through a lot of that sort of fame and stardom while he was a player. Jackie's eldest child, his daughter Sharon, was born when Jackie was essentially out of the game. So Jackie Jr. really experienced that, and then when Robinson, of course, had to travel a lot for baseball, and he continued to travel a lot in speaking engagements. He wasn't home as much as he later expressed the result he maybe should have been or could have been. So extremely difficult, you know, of course, to say the least, a seismic event in their life, the death of Jackie Jr., and it tied into all the struggles he had had.
My guest is Kostya Kennedy. The name of the book is True, The Four Seasons of Jackie Robinson. It is our choice for full bio. What did Jackie Robinson's activism look like in his later years?
So he was very attentive to, he was very aware of his platform. So he was Jackie Robinson. Everybody knew that name and knew what to associate with it. And he engaged in different ways. He engaged on a sort of public letters kind of way. He had a column for a while in the New York Post, and he had a syndicated column. He spoke about things. He also worked directly with the civil rights movement, especially with Dr. King. There was a pair of church burnings in Georgia, and King asked him to sort of take control of that project and raise funds for it and get them back on their feet, which he did. He was at the Dream Speech. Robinson represented the Connecticut delegate down to the Dream Speech and went with his whole family and was met with Martin Luther King before the speech and sat up on the dais. He was also an activist in the more grassroots level of economic empowerment. He would help to found a bank, the Freedom National Bank, on 125th Street in Harlem. He, towards the end of his life, he was involved in a low-income housing construction company. He wanted people to have a chance to get jobs and make a little more money and have that empowerment. And so he was very active both on a public level and a sort of, you know, more localized private level as well.
In the course of his career, did his activism cost him anything?
I think it did. You know, and he alluded to something. He was asked, I think it was with the CBC, the Canadian Broadcast Company, you know, why are you doing this? Why are you so out there on issues? And remember, Allison, this is before Muhammad Ali, before Jim Brown had gotten active, before some of the athletes that we think of as activists were really doing it. So Robinson was an anomaly. And he spoke, he referenced being in Pasadena as a kid and being told he could only come swim at the public pool once a week. And then he said, you know, I received so many letters and so much attention during my time as a baseball player from people all over this country. And I mean, that's a whole other thing, the mountains of letters that would come for him, that I feel like I'd be letting people down if I wasn't doing this, because this is a fight we have to win. We have to win it today, tomorrow, for ourselves, for our kids. And he alluded, I could have not done this and maybe had a more comfortable, easier life. But it wasn't really a choice for him to not do it, a personal choice. He had to be active in that way. And there's no question it cost him. He never had a job in baseball after leaving the game. And he had initially very much wanted to have a manager's job. So that tells you that he was, for some people, kind of a live wire, and they didn't necessarily want to employ him because he was active in social issues.
As he got older, though, Jackie Robinson was not afraid to embrace corporate support. He was both an activist, but not particularly a militant activist. Very straightforward in his beliefs, though. Why did this avenue of activism work for him?
I think he was true to himself. I came upon that as the title of the book because it sort of struck me that I do think from an early age he was a rule follower and somebody who worked within systems, and that's what felt right to him. He sort of always had not only moral righteousness on his side, but also sort of he was right in the moment. He was, you know, he was playing by the rules, and this is how he's going to get it done. Just as like, well, just when you're a baseball player, you know, you can't cheat. You have to play the right way, and that's how you get it done. And that's how he approached his public effort in every way. And he absolutely, you know, there were times when you know, he feuded with Malcolm X, who didn't necessarily like that Robinson had good relationships with certain people in the corporate world or with white America. Robinson was open to that. He was open to working with anybody. He felt at one point he'd gotten a job at a different bank that was kind of a public, it seemed like a public sort of thing. Hey, we've got Jackie Robinson, you know, to sort of kind of appeal to people. And he addressed it head on. He said, you know, this might be a little bit of a grandstanding move, but if it shows some young black people that they can be a vice president in a bank or they can have these kind of job, that's what we're in it for. That's what we're trying to do. So he was pretty clear on what he was hoping to achieve, and it was in his nature to work within the bounds of that opportunity.
We're talking about True, the Four Seasons of Jackie Robinson by Kostya Kennedy. He is my guest. We chose it for full bio. You note in this last section that Jackie Robinson had not been on a baseball field for years. And we're talking about the year 1972. What was at the heart of his estrangement from the game he loved and the game he integrated and the game that he is so associated with?
Well, initially he wanted a job in coaching or managing, and that was not made available to him. Nobody found a place for him to have that job. Then as time went on a little more, he began to see that not only himself, but very, very few, at first none, and then very, very few, black people were getting any kind of jobs in management or anywhere in the front office of the baseball, and he didn't like that. He stopped going to old-timers games when he was invited because he had sort of a way to protest. But he also got involved. He got involved more broadly in other things. And he said even at one point, you know what, I initially wanted to stay in the game and stay and work in baseball, but I feel lucky that I didn't because it would have been so much more narrow of a path than being able to do some of the things we've just been talking about on all the different levels of society. So it's sort of one thing led on to another that drew him further and further away from the game as he grew older.
That's so interesting that you mentioned about the managers, because in one of his last public appearances, he mentions that.
Yep.
That the one thing he wants to see in the future is black managers.
So 1972, which is where we are now, when he says that, that was the year he had been distanced from the game. But in 72 was sort of a homecoming for him, and it felt very fitting in a way that he had gone to a funeral of Gil Hodges, an old teammate, in the beginning of 1972. And there he'd run into his old teammate, Don Newcomb, and other teammates he hadn't seen for a while. And Newcomb did have a job in baseball, one of the very rare African-Americans to have such a job. And said, hey, would you consider coming out and participating? Newcomb worked with the Dodgers. And Jackie said yes. And it began this sort of repatriation into the game, which is how he ended up on the field of the World Series, with just what you're alluding to, in Cincinnati. And he gives it's almost the quintessential Robinson moment in that he's brought up to the microphone and now is celebrating 25 years at that point since he had integrated the game, 1947 to 1972. And there are ex-teammates around him. And the first thing Robinson does is thank baseball, thank the commissioner, thank Pee Wee Reese, his good friend who's on the field beside him, talk about Branch Rickey, all the people who gave him an opportunity, very gracious. And then his last thing is to say, I'm very proud and pleased to be here today, but I will be even more proud and pleased when I see a black manager there in the third base box managing a baseball team. He was never going to lose an opportunity to have his voice heard, but he was going to do it in a gracious way. And this was just 9 days before he died. So he was extremely active right up to the end. And he was physically laboring at that point. He couldn't see very well at all, had severe circulation issues and such, but continued to press his message.
Okay. So Jackie Robinson died in 1972. He was just 53 years old. His funeral was at Riverside Church, and it really showed the impact that he had across the culture by various people who showed up. And it was interesting. I was watching an interview with Bill Russell preparing for this, and Rachel Robinson had asked Bill Russell to be one of the pallbearers. And Bill Russell said, why? And Rachel Robinson said, because you were one of his favorite athletes. And Russell said one of the things he admired about Jackie Robinson was that, and these are his words, he wasn't a pushover.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, and we see a lot of that in Bill Russell, too. And that's absolutely true. He, you know, Robinson, except for some very calculated few moments in his baseball career, didn't take it sitting down. And you did not run an injustice by Jackie Robinson. So he very much stood up for not only himself, but for the right cause, what he felt was the righteous stance in a given situation. When Russell was first asked, he broke into tears because Robinson had meant so much to him. And he said, what an unbelievable honor to be asked to be a pallbearer. You can see a lot of similarity between those two men.
Rachel Robinson continued on with their life's work of trying to help others. Specifically, they were very interested in minority students getting higher education. That's how she said it. They started a foundation, the Jackie Robinson Foundation. What was her day-to-day role there, and what was her life like? What was she concentrating on after the love of her life passed away?
Yeah, it was an incredible time in her life. So Robinson died in 72, and this is just a year after Jackie Jr. died in 1971. So her life has really been blown apart. And they started the Jackie Robinson Foundation within a year of Jackie's death. And she did. She believed in education. She had a nursing degree. She worked in public health. She was very active in that way professionally, and she believed that education was the single biggest key towards advancement and towards opportunity. And that's what they decided to focus the Jackie Robinson Foundation on. And she was extremely involved. Very much two things that she did, well, many other things, but two principal things was look over Jackie's legacy. And the reason why there's never been an official Jackie Robinson bobblehead doll, for example, and that's because Rachel Robinson said, no, that's not respectful enough. We're not going to do that. But also to preside over this Jackie Robinson Foundation and keep it to where she thought it would be. They'd have a board of people who would sometimes encourage the foundation to get into civil rights discussions, whether in sports or outside of sports. And she said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to do education, and we're going to do it as well as we can, and that's how we're going to make a difference. And 50 years later, and it's been an enormous success, Rachel, who is still with us and will turn 100 in July, is no longer active at the foundation, but the foundation itself is very much active and it's continued to grow. And they just changed so hundreds and hundreds of lives by giving kids an opportunity to go to school and also providing mentorship services throughout. They were a very early adopter of that, so that their graduation rate is something like 98% because they're supporting kids throughout the journey. So Rachel certainly, you know, carried the baton and wanted to do something in her own spirit and, of course, in Jackie's spirit after he died.
I have to tell you, I think it must have been 6 or 7 years ago, I emceed one of the scholarship events for Jackie Robinson Foundation. And I got to meet Mrs. Robinson, and she is so elegant. And she was very invested in those kids and knew each kid's name and wanted to know everything about them. It was really interesting to watch. And it was a very warm event, I remember.
That sounds wonderful. Yeah, somebody said to me, it was really good for people to meet Rachel Robinson because once you've met her, and she's watching you in college, nobody wants to let down Rachel Robinson. So the kids are going to do their best to get through their microeconomics classes and stuff.
My last two questions for you. This requires some informed speculation, is how I'll put it.
Okay.
If Jackie Robinson were to be eulogized now,
What do you think would have been highlighted about his life and his work as opposed to what was highlighted 50 years ago?
You know, I think that the man who gave his eulogy 50 years ago was Jesse Jackson at Riverside Church. And I will say that it's a pretty moving eulogy that did cover him quite well. I think that we would see a person who remained engaged, entirely engaged, that his... Let me say this. When Robinson went into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1962, by his decision, his plaque on the Hall of Fame, which describes his accomplishment, didn't say anything about him being the first black player, didn't say anything about performing under difficult circumstances. That's the way Jackie said it should be. It just said, here's his baseball accomplishment, and here he is. And that's what Jackie wanted, to just be seen on an equal, same playing field. In 2008, I want to say, right in the 2000s, with Rachel's, at Rachel's urging and cooperation, they changed that plaque to include the baseball stuff, but also say what he had played through and what he had done. And to me, I think that that's sort of representative of how we would have seen, we'd see him maybe more as a full figure and recognize a little more for how ahead of his time he had been in so many ways, if we would look back from today's perspective. And certainly, you know, we're all sitting in a different chair in 2002 than in 1972. We're sitting in a different chair in 2022 than we were in 2015, of course. And so he had, we bring ourselves to that evaluation, but I think that he would be have a real wide lens around him to see the way he impacted lives.
Last question. As we remember Jackie Robinson, what is something you think gets left out of the conversation?
I think that one thing that's not drawn in so much, and we've had an opportunity to touch on this together over the discussion, is the separation. There isn't such a big separation between him as an athlete and him as a person and an activist. The other, he was a very intelligent and very thoughtful man, person, but he wasn't an orator like Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or other civil rights leaders. That wasn't his tool. His tool, in many ways, was his body, was expressing himself, showing possibility, showing opportunity by the way he played the game and the way he carried himself. And that vehicle stayed. He never untethered himself from that, even as he branched out into areas that had nothing specifically to do with baseball whatsoever. And I think to me that the sort of metaphorical or, you know, representative aspect of his style of play and the success in play really do tie into him being the person and the change maker that he was both in and outside the game.
The name of the book is True, The Four Seasons of Jackie Robinson by Kostya Kennedy. Kostya, thank you so much for all of your time. We really appreciate you spending the week with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, and have enjoyed so much talking with you, Allison.
Thanks again to Kostya Kennedy for giving us so much time, and also thanks to Full Bio engineer Jason Isaac and post-production producer Luke Green. All four Full Bio conversations about True, The Four Seasons of Jackie Robinson will be available in the All of It podcast feed.
Did you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? Did he hit it? Yes! And that ain't all, he stole home!
Yes, yes, Jackie's real gone. Cause Jackie is a real